session is the first in the series on environmental ethics. This is an overview and a look at some of the issues. You've probably had a chance to read my biography. If you maybe you haven't taken the time, I won't say much about myself. I'm presently doing a doctorate at the University, well, at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. It's a joint degree program with the University of California, Berkeley. I'm an ELCA pastor and had done work in natural resources, a BS in natural resources from Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, and an MPH in environmental public health. So I had done quite a bit of study before I went to seminary on environmental issues and have been real interested in trying to keep up with them along the way, and I'm really excited to be here and to be able to sort of integrate the two concerns that I've studied a great deal through my life here at Holden Village. So I'd like to start by learning a little bit about who you are, your name, where you're from, and if you have any special concerns about the environment, say in your region or something, I'd like to know that too. So should we start here?
Dallas Young, parish pastor, Fargo, North Dakota.
Vic Gustafson, teacher of physical education at the State of Scouts College, St. Peter.
And I'm Betty Gustafson.
I'm Terry Thompson from Minneapolis. I work for BFI, which is a very large waste, solid waste trash hauling company. So I have some very obvious concerns about what we're doing with our environment.
I'm Janet Thompson from Eagan, Minnesota, and I guess in terms of a stewardship perspective is where my interest is.
Good. I'm Karen Kraska, I'm from Seattle, and I guess living outside of Seattle, I'm kind of concerned about the rapid overdevelopment of the city.
Debbie Christensen from Kirkland, Washington, and I'm interested in seeing the quality of water improved and the lakes there and recycling programs in the neighborhood.
Chris Anderson in Kirkland, Washington. I work as a groundwater consultant. We deal with contaminated groundwater.
Sorry, I'm late. I'm Sarah Nyberg from Columbus, Ohio. And I'm not sure if I know your question, but you're asking why we're interested in your...
Well, just if you have any special concerns about environmental issues.
I'm not sure that I do. Thank you.
I'm Ron Jacobson. I'm a contractor from Seattle, Washington, mostly houses.
Phyllis Jacobson.
I'm Claire Aiktwit, out of Marco Teo. I process fish.
I'm Hilke Aiktwit, also from Marco Teo. And I'm very interested in recycling and in the preservation of the wetlands in our area.
I'm Christine George, and I'm interested in the Lake Michigan area in terms of the preservation of the dunes and the shoreline and the quality of Lake Michigan, and also because I'm allergic to practically everything, the quality of the air.
I'm Don Bottomiller from Ordina, Minnesota, manufacturer of porch patio furniture. I'm concerned that on how we as consumers integrate our desires with the realities of the economic system in which we live.
I'm Nancy Bottomiller, and I'm interested in the dialogue
when we were doing this. I'm Kit Nagle from Watertown, Connecticut. The big issue out there is most of the coastline of the East Coast is shut down now from medical waste.
Right. Yeah.
My name is Du from Thailand. I study ocean education. I'm just interested in environmental in general.
I'm Joy Wise from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I've been concerned about water this summer since we haven't had much. Mississippi has been going down steadily all summer.
I'm Doug Wise from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I'm a city planner.
Charles Lutz from Minneapolis. I've done some writing and some teaching in the area of agricultural, the way we farm and what it does for the land base and the conservation of both soil and water in agriculture.
My name is John Marshke. I'm a Minnesotan living in Ann Arbor. And I'm worried about the ozone layer.
Darius Larson, campus pastor, avid gardener and bird watcher, and it's definitely affecting me with that. And my theology affects it.
John Van Roden, Federal Way, Washington. I'm in lay ministry and I teach ethics, adult classes in the church.
I'm Mary Wallen. I'm living in St. Paul, and I'm interested in integrating theology with environmental issues in a general sort of way.
I'm Joyce Carlson from Plymouth, who is here, separate from Minneapolis. And the reception is in our church. We have a cycling place, and I think it's off the ground on its way.
Great.
I'm Alan Carlson from Minneapolis. I have visited one gold mine and I found out how they tore up the countryside. The creeks are just a mess. I think that's bad.
In the back here, give me names if you have any special interest in environmental concerns.
Right.
Yeah. Can you just do Floyd?
Well, having had to teach environmental geology for several years, I am interested in opening my ears and see what other people think.
My name's Dan Gifford, and I've been here for 11 months, where we've been dealing with some of our own recycling, particularly styrofoam, plastics, alternative sources of heat.
I'm Ann Kohlberg, and I've been here calling for a year, and I also worked at Yellowstone National Park.
Introduce themselves, who's come in since we started here? Well, why don't you anyway, if you do. You if you came in.
Well, I'm Miriam Swine, and I don't know anything about any environmental issues.
Well, then we're glad you're here. Well, we're glad all of you are.
I'm Marilyn Scott. I'm from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And I'm interested in environmental issues from a number of standpoints. We're having drastic climatic changes, including tornadoes, which we haven't had, and snowfalls in May, which have killed all the blossoms so nothing grows. And I think there are many people that are attributing that to our messing up the environment, so I'm interested in that.
Any others that we didn't? Yeah.
I'm Priscilla Madsen from Vancouver, Washington, and I work for a large electronics company. There are definitely concerns there.
Yes,
sure. I'm Helen McCaskey from Ottawa, Montana. We live on the lake and we really notice the difference in the algae forming earlier and earlier every day.
I'm the other guy.
Did we miss anybody? Okay. I'm really glad to see you all here. Pleased to see that you're interested in these issues. It's really exciting, as I said, for me to be able to present on these issues because they've been a concern to me for a long time. I'd like to begin with a prayer. I think that helps to focus our thinking and to remind us of why we're here and concerned. Well, God, you have brought us together as guests and stewards in the midst of these majestic mountain peaks and on this earth. We give you thanks for these gifts. As we are here awed by the beauty of your creation, teach us to live our lives full of care for all of your gifts of the earth. Amen. Holden is an environmentalist dream. We're surrounded by the beauty of creation, away from the noise and the crowds. And here we've also seen and heard from responsible stewards that who are modeling lifestyles of environmental responsibility. Most of you are aware of the summer theme, something is afoot in the universe. This, I believe, was taken from something that Elmer Witt sent us earlier this spring. It's taken from a writing of Teilhard de Chardin. Many of you are aware of his work, I'm sure. He was a Jesuit priest and a paleontologist, a scientist who loved the earth and the physical universe. I'll read that quotation. It's from a book called Human Energy, translated into English in 69. I believe it was written in the 20s or 30s. Something is afoot in the universe. A result is working out which can best be compared to a gestation and birth. The birth of a new spiritual reality formed by souls and the matter they draw after them. Laboriously, by way of human activity and thanks to it, the new earth is gathering, isolating, and purifying itself. No, we are not like flowers in a bunch, but the leaves and flowers of a great tree on which each appears at its time and place, according to the demands of the all. When Teilhard was writing, the Industrial Revolution had taken place, but it wasn't apparent yet what some of the problems were going to be of that industrialization. He had a vision of the interconnectedness of humanity and nature, almost a spiritual connection, a joint evolution of humanity and culture and the physical world. It's this kind of vision that may form the basis for an environmental ethic, even for us who know that things aren't quite as rosy as he might have seen them at that time. Some of you know the work of Phil Hefner. He's a teacher of systematic theology at the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. He often talks about humanity and their role in the earth as created co-creators. He wants to emphasize the role of humanity in the continuing creation of God's earth. With this phrase, we see how nature and our views toward nature, our use of it and abuse of it, is significant in God's act of creation. So what about environmental ethics? There are a lot of ways to approach this. We can only cover the basics tonight and in the few sessions we will have this week. As you've probably already guessed, we'll approach it from a Christian ethical perspective. As you know, there are many, philosophical approach to ethics, many definitions of ethics. One is ethics as practical reason, that is the exercise of our rational selves in the tackling and in the looking at practical problems. Some of you saw the film strip last night, I believe. Were any of you there last night when Barry showed the film strip about wilderness camping?
Yes. There
were quite a few there, so I thought some of you would have to be. Film strip was called Without a Trace, and it emphasized how one can do wilderness camping without leaving marks behind on the landscape. This type of wilderness ethic, it struck me that we could hear, or anyone who does wilderness camping in any places, could in a way try to carry that back into society. Now certainly we can't live without a trace on the land where we are because of relying on industry and all as we do. But I'd like us to think about as we go on, is there any way that we can carry the insights of this Holden ethic, perhaps we might call it, when we leave here and go back to our usual lifestyles. Hopefully as close to lifestyles here as we can manage them. In that film strip, there was a definition given of ethics. It was a film strip put out by the Forest Service. The narrator said that ethics was, or is, a private code of conduct. That struck me a bit, and I talked with Barry about that afterwards, and he and I agreed that maybe we don't really want to talk about a private code of conduct when we're talking about the environment. Perhaps in wilderness camping we can talk about private conduct, because in that kind of setting it is one or two, three or five people who are impacting on the environment. And it's more or less private behavior. But an ethic even like that has to have some basis and some agreement in common with others. We can't just have an individual ethic about the environment. And in that case, we want to leave the environment in a condition that's going to be pristine for the next people who come there. So we're seeking good not only for ourselves, but for others as well. And it strikes me that that idea of the private code of conduct as being what ethics is reflects a rather individualistic attitude that's prevalent in our culture, where we seek perhaps the individual or family good oftentimes over against what might be the good of society. Now that private good, that I'm not talking just about family kinds of relationships, but where people seek their own economic good and don't consider what kinds of impact it's going to have on the community or on the environment. And that's at the heart of environmental problems. That is, what is good for the individual and for the economy. I think someone raised the issue already. What's good for the economy of a community, of our country, and how does that impact the environment?
I immediately think, isn't also convenience.
Oh,
The only word that comes to my mind is the convenience of it.
Oh, yes. We all, I'm guilty of eating at fast food places because it's convenient, using styrofoam containers, putting up with that because it's convenient.
Yeah, and more convenient than
I think both play into it. When you get into some of the larger issues, it's I think it is economic too. But we'll discuss that maybe later, further later, when we get into more of the issues. I think the idea of the common good is an important one when we get especially into environmental ethics, well, any ethics. Some of you have seen the book that Charles Lutz wrote on Holden Village. I just happened to note in the first part of the book where his publications are listed, a book that came out last year that he wrote called God, Goods, and the Common Good. So we have an expert on ethics here in our midst, so I'll hope to get into some...
That book is about the Catholic bishop's letter on the economy.
On the economy, okay. Yeah.
And I was one of 11 writers. I assembled it and wrote one chapter, but there are 10 other writers.
Okay. So that... thank you. Oh, well, I'm still impressed.
It's all tithing.
And tithing, right. Even though I wasn't sure that the book was about the environment, in fact, I thought it probably was not, but I think that the ethical issue is similar, and that is, what is good for the private individuals in the case of economics and in the case of environmental concerns. I think there's commonality in the ethics grounding the issues there.
And the two intersect constantly.
Oh, yes.
Environmental concerns and economics.
Yes, definitely. One of my advisors at Berkeley, at Ted Peters, teaches at the Pacific Lutheran School of PLTS. You never remember what they stand for.
Pacific Lutheran Theological Center.
Thank you. Has recently been involved in doing a consultation with a group of industrial leaders and government leaders on the locating toxic waste disposal sites. And he has talked about the very same thing, that it really seems to be an issue of what is the common good in making decisions about things like locating waste disposal sites. And we can't really separate the common good from private goods, because they certainly intersect, as I'm sure you all are well aware, because the long-range goods always affect the individuals, whereas in the short term, it may seem something is beneficial in the, for the individual. In the long range, it affects, the detrimental effects affect everybody. Someone mentioned the warming of the atmosphere or the climatic changes. Now, there are questions about that, but I think that that's one of the issues that has come up, especially this summer, with questions about the greenhouse effect. We'll get to that a little bit later, too, and the pollution of the beaches on the East Coast. I think these issues are bringing the environmental concerns closer to home. People are seeing pollution on the beaches. The eastern people can't go to their favorite shoreline retreats over the summer because of rats, hospital wastes, and vials of blood that have washed up onto the shoreline there. So these are beginning, are causing some fear and horror about what we are doing to our seas and to our world. It seems to me that the church is a natural place to start talking about, or to continue talking about, the common good and concerns of our society. Many of you have been involved in getting the church involved in public issues, and Lutherans haven't always been real good at that. We tend to be a little bit quiet and let others take the lead politically, but I think it's our responsibility as a church. We think of Paul's example about the parts of the body functioning together. I think we have something to teach the society about the common good and community ethics. This same idea was mentioned this afternoon in Chris's session on youth and problems of youth in society. It's really a problem of the community, and there have to be community values that work together to support ethics that maintain quality education and things for youth, maintain quality environment. As I was driving out here from Tacoma, I saw something, a sign that struck me, that really caught my attention. I saw it twice. The sign said, it's a mile ahead, viewpoint. And usually, I think when I've seen those before, it will say vista point or scenic view. Scenic view. And it struck me because usually when you think of viewpoint, you think of an individual's opinion about something. Yeah. It's my viewpoint.
Yeah.
And in this case, it was, viewpoint was the point from which one would go to see the vision, the view at a distance. And it was the view that anyone who went there would have of that scene. It was the common view. And it seems like that's something like what we're talking about with environmental ethics. We may think of it as a private opinion, but isn't it really what we have, or should it not be, the vision that we have of the future and the vision that all of us see of the life on the earth together? I think the church is also a good place to talk about that because we are the ones who hear about the promised reign of God, which is promised in the future, but is already among us in Jesus Christ. And so we have this basis for a vision of the creation and new creation, which influences our behavior here and now. In the early 70s, some of you may have seen the article by Lynn White called "The Historical Roots of the Ecological Crisis." I was in college at that time, I believe in my first year of college, and on a retreat with our campus parish in Ann Arbor, when someone referred to that article. And I think it was at that point that I began to feel a good bit of responsibility for the environment. In that article, Lynn White accuses the Judeo-Christian tradition of being in large part responsible for the environmental problems. He refers to the passage from Genesis, "Be fruitful and multiply and subdue the earth." And though there have been rebuttals written, and there are lots of things that one can say in opposition to that viewpoint, that has received a lot of attention. That idea that it is the Judeo-Christian tradition that has supported the continual use of natural resources, but it's also the Judeo-Christian tradition that has a tradition of stewardship of the earth. And it's encouraging that now, since the early 70s, when many of the problems have been brought out, many churches are taking responsibility in leadership over against environmental issues. The objection has been raised that environmental concerns take attention away from more pressing problems of society, such as the needs for education and the needs of the poor. It's often been said that environmental concern is an elitist problem. People who are more affluent are the ones who go out hiking in the wilderness and have more concern about the environment because of that, and that the cost of environmental cleanup takes money away from poverty programs. But that's really a false distinction, because it is often the poor who are hurt the worst by environmental degradation. You often see the worst water quality, the worst air quality in the inner cities, water quality in parts of the country where the resources aren't available for people to have clean water. So the problems are really very interrelated. Environmental concerns are connected with justice concerns. Rosemary Ruther points out in the book Sexism and God Talk that very interconnection based on the Old Testament scriptures. For the Hebrews, justice was tied to the functioning of nature. And when justice was not done, nature rebelled. We can think of many passages from the prophets where that's true. There are many figures throughout the history of our land who have played important roles in trying to call attention to the problems at earlier stages already. Many of you may know of Aldo Leopold, and the Sand County Almanac was an early work. I think it came out in 1949. He already then was promoting a land ethic, an ethic that would go beyond anthropocentrism, that is, an ethic that would include the land and the earth, and wasn't just concerned about the issues that directly affect human beings, although we have come to see that the issues of the environment have come around to affect our health and our well-being as well. It was in the early 70s when a lot of these things were brought to our attention. First Earth Day was in Ann Arbor in 1970. We recall some of the images of that time, the spaceship Earth. That's a helpful one to remember now. Through the years since that time, especially over the last decade, a lot of our concerns have slacked off. Legislation and enforcement have declined. So there is much to be done. We have a couple of more sessions this week. I'll just go over briefly what we'll cover. Tomorrow I'd like to go a little further into, I think the session's tomorrow afternoon, into the grounding for environmental ethics. We'll talk about the rights of species other than human. Then Thursday morning I'd like to discuss especially the doctrine of creation and eschatology and the connection with our environmental concern. How is our theology related to issues of the environment? And then on Friday night, and this I think should invite you all to attend as many or any that you're able to attend, Friday night we'll talk at more length about the practical issues. Who pays and what can we do? How can we act to take some responsibility in concrete ways about things in our own communities or whatever else. As far as resources go, I've listed one, or the bookstore has several books. They have one that they had already in stock that I asked them to get. It's called Cry of the Environment, Rebuilding the Christian Creation Tradition. This gives some of the backgrounds in Christian teachings, ways that we can look again at the teachings of the church in new ways, a new way of looking at the teachings of the church that are responsible and concerned about the environment. There's Phil Hefner has one article in here. One of my Ted has an article in here. This was published in Berkeley. One of my other advisors has one on. Phil's is on creation, viewed by science, affirmed by faith. These are not easy articles, but they're very good, and I encourage you to take a look at it. At least take a look at it in the bookstore if you're by there. Resources. I'm not going to try to list them all for you tonight. If you have special interests, I could probably dig up something that could help you with. We'll go into that a little more on Friday, including groups that you might get involved with if you are concerned. Now, okay, we're doing pretty well here. And there are environmental groups in various parts of the country that you can get involved with, and it really is helpful to not try to go at it alone. You know, there are it's much easier to work with a group on this, a church group or community group. Before we go into the issues, I just wanted to say something about Holden. Is sort of a microcosm. I've begun to see it as sort of a microcosm of the way we might view society. Here there's almost a closed system, an ecological system that seems to take care of itself. I don't know if it's just a new thing this summer, but their recycling program I was really impressed by. In fact, just brought tears to my eyes to hear how very few people, I'm sure, who could get that excited about garbage.
Garbage brings tears to my eyes.
Maybe not in the same way.
I was just so impressed with the fact that you're taking that kind of time to do the recycling, recycling, composting, and the other kinds of things that you do to take care of the environment here. And I heard that it was particularly one person on your staff, Steve, who kind of motivated everybody and got interest going in it. So it shows that one person can do something if you have interest and enough concern.
But you have a built-in group of people that have a concern.
Yes, and who have the similar values.
Out there is different.
That's right.
You also have here the requirement of doing certain things or the Forest Service will ask us to leave. I think that's another factor.
Sure it is.
She's talking about something that's not required by the Forest
Service. Recycling isn't, right? Yeah. That's voluntary.
The overall closed system of this place, I think, that's been from the beginning here. Kind of a given.
Wouldn't it be beautiful? I mean, that's, you know, this spaceship Earth thing. You know, wouldn't it be beautiful if we could think of the world, which it is, as a closed system?
Yeah.
Which it is. Yeah. But how we think of Holden as a closed system.
Yeah, right.
But because we can see its boundaries, it's much easier to see it as
exactly.
A closed system.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I certainly encourage you to, if you have any thoughts and reflections on what we've already talked about, encourage you to pick up on that. There are so many issues that we could address. We'll be able to just touch on them, and we'll come back to them throughout the week. When we start on talking about environmental problems, it can get to be as Floyd and a couple of us were discussing earlier, it can get to be a discussion of how bad things are. And they are, you know, if you look at them quite seriously. There are some really bad conditions that we need to take seriously. But as we go through these issues, it's important to see them also from the aspect of stewardship and that things really can be done. Again, Floyd may bring this up. In ecology, there is a term called the threshold effect, and that means that at a certain level, an environment cannot take any more of use or abuse, and it won't recover or will take a long time to recover. That's true of an organism or an ecosystem. But at the same time, I think most of the issues that you have concerns about, that we have concerns about, are at a level where we can do something. Maybe it doesn't seem like it as individuals, but I think it still as a society, if we are able to see them as serious enough problems, it is something that can be addressed. Now, I guess I will go through and list just a couple. You've raised a lot of the issues at the beginning, in fact, more than I had listed. I know we cannot talk about all of them. And maybe I'll just leave it to you to choose which, if any particular ones are of more interest to you, we'll just pick up on those. Solid waste management is one that we've already been addressing here with the recycling program. Several of you had concerns about recycling programs in your communities. This is a sort of a recycler's paradise.
Uh-huh. One of the things that strikes me is that we're a throwaway society, and we have so many paper products now are single use. Right. They're used once and then discarded. And this is one of the problems with these hospitals.
Right.
In the good old days, that wasn't the true way. We reused and reused things. But now, they use them once and discard them. That's why they got all these syringes and needles on the beaches. And this is true in their fast food. And in your own living, I mean, how much paper do we use that we just discard very casually? And I think this is, it can be burned, yes.
The paper can, but the
paper can, but there's a
the
lot
plastic
that isn't,
stays around. Right.
But this whole philosophy of throwaway kind of goes into food, too.
Oh yes,
and the way we handle our food, and then don't tell me that doesn't affect our economics. Mm-hmm. Oh. It certainly affects the cost of hospital care, I am sure.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So individual congregations don't model things very well either. I'm thinking of plastic throwaway communion cup, the throwaway Bible, that is in terms of inserting the lessons mm-hmm. into the bulletin, which becomes another piece of paper to be thrown away. And at least in the upper Midwest, you cannot have a church service without coffee afterwards, served almost always in Starbucks.
Yeah. Kitchens full of cups.
Yeah, yes. Right, yeah. Which are never used. You
know, but thanks to Lutheran Brotherhood, they're free. No, I mean the Lutheran Brotherhood cup. I mean,
where you live, or the church, where you live, if you had an acre of land, and you knew that whatever you used, you had to dispose of on that acre of land, I think our use would be really different. But what happens is someone else takes
That's
care
right.
of it, and it goes somewhere else, just like we're trying to do some of the recyclable stuff in the third world, right? Aren't we trying to take some of our waste? And dump it yep. other places, or you know, cities dump it in rural areas.
Yeah, the garbage barge we tried to send down south.
Yeah. But if we, you know, I was realizing that when I started to have a summer home, and it wasn't, you know, you had to take your garbage into the dump yourself. And suddenly, you know, what you used and how you use it, you know, became a much greater hassle than if I just had to throw everything in a plastic bag and put it on the corner and the garbage man picked it up.
Oh yeah, I think that's a big part of the problem in the cities. The more dense the population is, the farther you are from what happens with what you use. Mm-hmm. You just dump it down the garbage chute and never see it again. You think you never see it again.
So you go swimming at your beach.
I can't argue. I don't know any statistics, but I have a feeling that the reason, though, that hospitals use throwaway disposable materials is because of the cost of washing making them usable again. I may be wrong, but I think that hospitals really operate on the premise of the bottom line dollar cost, and for least for many things, except some things that I might cite. But if they're doctors, they probably wouldn't like that. So I won't say that. But if that, I think that that's an economic factor, is the cost of redoing is the...
I can't believe it's as great as purchasing these things.
Well, I don't know.
I'm a nurse, and I think the thing is the cost of infections caused by things that aren't sterilized correctly, you end up, it costs more if somebody gets an infection as a result. And, like, I wouldn't feel safe having somebody use a re-sterilized needle on me. It's just been proven it's not effective. You know, and so I wouldn't feel safe that way. And if somebody gets an infection as a result of non-sterile things, it costs the hospital more in the long run, so it does come down to cost, too.
Yeah, I think that's a kind of a tricky issue with that because of infections. I think that there's probably good reason.
But then there are wash basins and water containers and all that that are all thrown away too, and that's all plastic. You know, the needles is one thing.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Well, you can throw away glass rather than throw away plastic.
People get all their equipment when they go home. Mm-hmm. They get a bedpan and a wash basin and cups and all of it. And I know people that have several sets of those, and they don't
know. This is yours for life.
Your trophies for somebody.
Is that cost cheaper, much cheaper in Thailand to reuse? You know, just only the big hospital and have a lot of money to reuse is possible. So
they, it costs more to use disposable syringe. Mm-hmm. And plus the reason of infection also. Part of waste that goes exactly true. I used to work in a hospital laboratory, and they did go to disposable test tubes and things just because it cost too much to have somebody washing them and putting forward the technology.
But you know, part of it is again that they isolate the cost, because if they, you know, they'll say, okay, it's cheaper to get a disposable test tube than to pay someone to wash it and to use the hot water and stuff like that. But if part of the cost of the disposable was also disposing of it, and the cost it was society, and that was put onto it, but the hospital only sees it from its economic system. It doesn't belong.
And say, with styrofoam cups, I know, as opposed to other throwaway kinds of biodegradable materials, the styrofoam cup is cheaper. But there again, it's not looking at what the impact is.
The long range cost to society.
The total cost of using it is not built into the price.
That's exactly right.
And I think that's the basic problem, that the economics of it are not truly present for the consumer. Some communities, maybe Shakopee's doing this where you work, Doug, some communities now charge for garbage disposal according to the volume of it, and putting an incentive therefore on producing less garbage because it costs you less to have it hauled away.
I can get
anybody live in a community that does that?
10 gallon can instead of the scraping ones?
Yeah.
10 gallons a can a week, $1.50 a month.
So you pay less if you have less garbage?
$1.50 a month is against $6.50 or something like that if you use a big container. And that's quite an incentive to me.
Another example of how economics works positively is the mandatory deposit on beverage containers. Mm-hmm. States that have that have found a remarkable response because it hits your pocketbook.
Right.
You get the money back. And progressive Minnesota has not been able to pass that legislation because it's in the economic disinterest of the labor union. The labor unions are opposing it. They say because it takes jobs away from people who make those things. Yeah. And they're right, it would take jobs away.
The other interesting thing that's happened with some of the garbage haulers is that they are now involved in the recycling process. The one we were using asked that you separate your glass and your paper out from
the... we're not. I would very willingly have my 5 garbage cans out there, and I put my this and my this and my this. I would take the time to do that. I'm not willing to take the time. There's where I draw the line. I'm not willing to take the time to fill up the pickup, drive it clear into Seattle, do what I have to do with it. I'm not willing to do that. I gladly, routinely do it. If someone came to my door, pick it up, or it was a lot closer. Mm-hmm. But any kind of recycling, we're talking, you know, 20 miles one way, and then it's not...
there has been some churches who have developed recycling programs that every Sunday you bring, first Sunday of the month you bring paper, second Sunday of the month you bring aluminum cans, the third Sunday of the month, you know, and it's a youth project, or, you know, in one sense, at one church, a senior citizen project that just did this regularly, and they just, and they drove them in, and there you don't have to drive so far. So if you can get your church to do that, they can, the whole church can take one trip to Seattle.
Yeah.
Not to pay the pastor, is it?
Christmas, your offering. You know, there's just little kind of silent witnesses. I didn't even know I was doing this until this summer. I've lived in St. Cloud for 3 years, you know, outside the city limits, and I bring all my stuff into St. Cloud to our college center where they do have a recycling program. And every Friday I put out a garbage can. And my neighbors got talking to me one day, and they couldn't understand how us family of four can have one garbage can every week. And then I started looking, and my neighbors were having 4, 5, 6 garbage cans out every week, and I didn't even realize. But you know, I do compost, and I do you know some other things, and how much that does decrease the volume. But I mean, there's still junk in there that I wish I could do other things with. But just put out one garbage can and your neighbors may notice.
I think we're moving very fast toward mandatory recycling programs in municipalities, that they will require it.
They're running out of space for landfills.
Yeah, that's right.
It's just going to be.
And I think we're going to have to do it involuntarily very soon.
I know that's happening up where we are, where they've been trying for about 2 years to find a new dump. And every time they decide to put it someplace, well, then the whole community in that area gets up in arms and writes letters politically. So then they decide, well, no, that one's not going to work, so let's try it someplace else. And they've been doing this for 2 years. And I think just before we left, there was the first sort of inkling that there were a couple of other considerations, like a recycling program and that type of thing that they were going to look at, rather than this frustration of trying to find a dump that nobody wants.
Seattle started a voluntary curbside recycling program and about well over a year ago. And it's been such a success that they want to expand.
What was it though that they just, grass clippings or yard clippings, they've only now, in a very small community, is that it?
Yeah,
and they all supply the garbage, the purple garbage can.
20%, what they do is provide you plastic garbage, but anyway, sacks to put in your yard clippings, and they figured that the landfill there is on the Superfund list, and they're still using it, but they figured by cutting out yard clippings, it would be 20% less volume that they put in the landfill, and they were resupplying the bags as you use them, and they call them away.
But how are we going to
get the companies to stop the throwaway? I was using a typewriter at church the other day and got to the end of the ribbon and asked, how do you turn it back? You don't. You put on another
cartridge.
Ribbon.
Yeah, all right.
You throw that one away. Yeah. And you buy a camera. One roll of film and then you throw the camera away. We can talk about recycling after we get the stuff, but how are we going to get some of these companies to do some reusable type of thing?
That's a really good question.
If you don't buy it, they won't make it.
Yeah. Disposable diapers won't work if people stop buying them.
That's right.
Well, there's a letter over at the post office. A real good example too. Chris Borges wrote to the National Public Radio about the packaging and stuff he received, and he got a letter back from them that they were exploring other ways to do it. A letter write.
A letter will make a great deal of difference, and it makes a double difference if it's handwritten and not typewritten, because we feel that you actually, with computers now, they figure people can rip these things off and nothing. But if you take the time to handwrite it, also, particularly if you write government officials, the impact of that is about 25 to 50 times what it would if you typed a thing. So even scribbling a note on the back of a postcard and sending it will have some impact. The other thing is, I was going to mention, I know our Safeway store is now putting their plastic bags, they now say are photo degradable. So you can't get them out of the sun for very long because it's
rum.
Only stop by Clavigan's.
I don't know how long that takes. They don't say what it's called, but it's a push to at least try to be community concerned that we either vote or they vote. They warn you not to leave them out in the sun for extended periods of time.
No problem, I guess.
Yeah.
And there was a time you went to the store though and you didn't have a bag. You had to bring your own.
Yeah.
That's probably something that can be done again, I think.
The problem is that people won't shop at that store.
I know.
They don't want to bring their own. They want it convenient.
The cost of paper bags was the number four or five cost of running a grocery store today. The cost of bags.
Wow.
Higher than the cost of, than almost anything else you do other than employees.
My brother lives back in Boston area, and they charge him 3 cents a bag when they buy groceries, and then if they come back and bring their bags, then they don't get charged.
That's a good system.
There's a certain mentality here, too. Let me tell you about my conservative Ohio community. Ohio is a state where New York sends its garbage. They send in all kinds of stuff, and we're putting it into some of our landfills there. I'm trying to do something about that. Springfield, we've lived there for 35 years, and until this last year, we have never been charged a cent for garbage pickup or trash pickup. And the city began running out of money, and they tried to institute charging. People would not charge. They would make midnight runs, and all the vacant lots in certain parts of town began to fill up with plastic bags. And old furniture and refrigerators and whatever, you know, that they could get rid of. So you're running into this kind of thing too. An uncooperative clientele, no, group of people that can't see this. They have certain things, certain inalienable rights, which was free garbage. And how can this city charge them for that sort of thing?
It's amazing.
Weren't they paying for it through their taxes, though?
Sure, or you can't convince them of that.
They had to be paying.
But part of it, I think, is also how, I mean, I don't know how they did it, and perhaps it's just there's this intransigent group of people in Springfield, Ohio. But, you know, sometimes how things are implemented, like if there's a really lot of discussion in public education on it ahead of time, I think more people will go along. You know, but if they see it as suddenly having, like you say, having to pay for something for free, and they really haven't bought into the idea yet, and then they're going to rebel against it.
Yeah, I think it goes back to the whole idea of community values, and which includes education, getting people in on decisions in the community. I mean, it's a whole different way of doing things than. It's hard in a large community, in large cities, to get people involved and to get people interested. But I think that's really necessary to get people looking at it with a sense of ownership, of participation.
One comment. As I've listened here for the past little bit, people have been focusing on concerns that they can see, mm-hmm. that they can touch. And as a society, as a world society, I guess would be my opinion, that the greater concerns are those that we cannot see, that we cannot touch. We hold a whole raft of concerns to it around. Someone did mention, the greenhouse effect. That's one issue of how we handle our chemical wastes and stuff like that. But we are a consuming society, and as I've been in Hong Kong and Taiwan, those places are virtual smokestacks compared to what we have here. And they have as great an influence on this spaceship Earth as what we do. And so I think that we have to, as a society, extend our concern for the environment and the way in which we live far, at least several orders of magnitude beyond the level that the last 20 minutes of discussion have taken.
I appreciate that comment, Don. I wanted to end with something on that. I think that it's good, though, to talk about what we can do. And
I was looking at my watch.
Very good. Help the leader out. I agree very, very wholeheartedly. And those are some of the issues that we weren't able to get to tonight. And perhaps I'm sure we will be able to get to some of them throughout the week. And it's not that those issues, as you said, we can't touch. They're much broader than the local congregation or whatever. But there is still a level at which we can have an influence on policy. With that, I think we need to break for Vespers very soon now. Appreciate all of your being here and your participation, and hope we'll continue this throughout the week.